Yes, but Janáček does dramatise more significantly by telling the story through profound contrasts and different voices, priest, angel and common Moravian folk. It's characterised. Listen to the creed and the passion with which he sets Christ's passion. The heavens being torn asunder at the moment of crucifixion, listen for the timpani, and then to the way in which the line about belief in the Catholic Church is not sung by the chorus but by the solo tenor. It's a heroic moment, but could that be Janáček's way of saying, I am moved by the passion, but it's the priest who believes in the church? There can be no very clear definition of Janáček's beliefs, even on the existence of the soul. He's sometimes adamant that it doesn't exist, but at others prepared to look into his own. For evangelists of belief or disbelief, his position will sound like intellectual laziness or even cowardice. I'd prefer to think of it as imaginative energy. His niece, Vera Janáčková, had a clear account of what he didn't like about religious practice.
He never went to funerals or cemeteries. He wanted to hear nothing of the dead and rarely spoke of them. In the old days, he would visit churches for atmosphere, preferably a monastery in Prague. But in later years, I could not get him into a church, even to shelter from the rain. A church, he told me, is concentrated death. Graves below the flagstones, bones at the altars, pictures all about martyrdom and dying. Pews, prayers, hymns, death and death again. I don't want to have anything to do with all that.
With no great hope of an afterlife, he couldn't glorify death.
Today, they are lifting the bells into the tower. It would be nice if they weren't calling people to bamboozling.
He pinned his faith in life and didn't want it to end. He also had a passion for passion itself, whether the passion of human love or the suffering of Christ. I don't think, incidentally, it mattered all that much whether Kamila really loved him or not. The excitement of her saying so, just once, was enough. And it's said that when she finally came to stay with him, with her small boy, he kept her awake all night, not with lovemaking, but by thumping his harmonium as he composed. To live was to work.
He was a very disciplined man. There was no doubt about that. He had a rigid work routine. He worked according to various deadlines. He worked incredibly hard, incredibly fast, and then had a few days off and then started all over again. No, he must have had a very strong belief in himself, although he doesn't enunciate it the whole time, saying, I'm a great composer and no one believes that. He just did it.
And when a dramatist is at work, his characters are as real as the ordinary mortals who surround him. So in one sense, at least, God was real for Janáček. In his biography, John Tyrrell points out that Janáček thought of himself as a prisoner for much of his life, a prisoner of poverty. He'd once had to practice Bach organ pieces on a keyboard drawn in chalk on a table, a prisoner of marriage, only occasionally happy, and, of course, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire until 1918. In relation to his marriage and his passion for Kamila, he used to write that he needed freedom of feeling. Composing gave him freedom, and feeling is everywhere in his mature work. Terse, intense, personal, too personal for institutional Christianity, perhaps, and very beautiful, the music always following the natural melody he found in Czech speech. The Mass is the work of a man who questioned the existence of the soul, but was preoccupied with a sense of the spiritual, perhaps more animistic than pantheist. It's triumphant music, a celebration of life, but human life or divine? His last great piece was the opera From the House of the Dead. Into Dostoevsky's stories of imprisonment in the most extreme and subhuman conditions, he introduced a positive role for a priest. And on his score, he wrote an epigraph, the only time he ever did this, and it was a quotation from the novel itself.
In every human being, a divine spark
music from Janáček's opera From the House of the Dead, concluding that exploration of the Czech composer's beliefs and what led him to write his Glagolitic Mass, which we're going to hear in a couple of minutes' time. It was written and presented by Paul Allen. The readers were Elaine Claxton, Peter Polycarpou and Susie Riddle. Janáček's Beliefs was produced by Julian May. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall and the first night of the BBC Proms 2011. Wonderful sight in front of me of tightly packed rows of promers, and then looking out the more reflective atmosphere high up in the gallery above us. A wonderful musical community gathered once again. And what a brilliant opening weekend. We've got Antonio Pappano conducting Rossini's opera William Tell tomorrow night, an organ recital by Stephen Farr on Sunday afternoon, and the eagerly awaited and very rare performance of Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony on Sunday evening. Benjamin Grosvenor, by the way, just taken a seat a couple of rows in front of me, surrounded by his family, and looking quietly pleased with his performance of the Liszt in part one of our concert. Well, right now we're ready for the BBC Symphony Chorus, BBC Singers and four soloists to join the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the Glagolitic Mass conducted by Jerzy Bielochlávek. I asked him why he wanted to bring this particular work to the Proms.
It's a piece I wanted to play for a long time.
It is so beautiful. Why is it beautiful? Because it's wonderfully written. It is full of emotion, because the piece has enormous energy in it, which is unleashed with very rare courage to use the extreme combinations. For instance, three piccolos, three trombones playing together the chords, accompanied with three sets of timpani. So that's just one very obvious moment. Or the use of choir, which is it's so passionate and it has such a strong influence on the listener, you know. And that's, I think this is a very typical situation for Janáček. His works never let you cold. You are always touched somehow, positively or negatively. It depends. But definitely it's one of the most original composer of 20th century, and for us, for Czech people.
Jerzy Bielochlávek, very proud of his Czech musical heritage. We've seen him conduct so many great Czech works with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. One of the most amazing facts about the Glagolitic Mass was that it was written by a non-believer, as we heard from Paul Allen in the interval. Though he'd been a student of the Augustinian monastery in Brno, Janáček proclaimed he wouldn't even go into a church to avoid the rain. He saw the work as being much more nationalistic than religious. It was a true Slavonic work, he said, marking the mission of Saints Cyril and Methodius to convert Moravia in 862, Glagolitic, the early form of the Cyrillic alphabet that they used to spread the word. Also work that proclaims his adoration for Kamila Stoslova, the woman he loved, even if it was an affair that existed in his mind rather than in reality. In this work, he said, I tried to depict the tale that when Christ was crucified on the cross, the heavens were rent. Well, now I do the noise and lightning flashes, but what if in heaven, in the portal, Kamila were to appear? I would portray that, he said, even better. Priest comes, Janáček wrote, nightingales, thrushes, ducks, geese make music, for their general wants to marry that dark girl, that small, tender, that dear Kamila. End of dream. You are already sleeping, Janáček wrote, and I daydream about you. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra now tuned and rising up behind the great mass forces of the BBC Symphony Chorus, augmented this evening by BBC Singers, an international cast of soloists to come on stage from Germany, from Russia, and two from the Czech Republic. We're going to be hearing the soprano Kibla Gerzmová, Dagmar Petzková, mezzo-soprano Stefan Finke, tenor, and Jan Martinique, bass. Glagolitic Mass, one of Janáček's last works, suggested by the Archbishop of Moravia after he'd unveiled a plaque to Janáček in his home village of Hochwaldy. So here are the soloists, Kibla Gersmova, Dagmar Petskova, Stefan Finke and Jan Martinique. Joining the BBC Singers, BBC Symphony Chorus, BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Bielochlávek. Jan Arček's Glagolitic Mass, live on the opening night of the BBC Proms 2011.
Oh, my God.
Janáček's Glagolitic Mass. BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Bielochlávek, BBC Singers, BBC Symphony Chorus, David Good, playing the mighty Royal Albert Hall organ, and soloists Kibler Yasmava, soprano, Dagmar Petskova, mezzo, tenor Stefan Finke, and bass Jan Martinić. If that's inspired you to listen to more of the rich sound world of Janáček, the Symphonietta, performed by the Halle Orchestra and Mark Elder here at the Proms next Thursday night. That last movement so drawing its resources from the earlier work of Janáček. He added the organ allegro and that orchestral coda in September of 1927. That's the version of the Glagolitic Mass that we heard this evening. It started out as a work written the previous summer, a wet summer, which kept Janáček at home and kept him composing. The work first heard in a convalescence home in the village where he was holidaying. Filled with sick people, the music played on the chapel harmonium, Janáček himself declaiming the vocal parts in a hoarse baritone. Unlike tonight's great soloists and chorus, the BBC Symphony Chorus, their chorus master Stephen Jackson on stage at the moment, bringing his forces to their feet, augmented tonight by the BBC Singers. BBC Singers, real backbone of the Proms. 8 concerts this year, including 3 Proms Saturday matinees. Abauno from the soloists. Kibler Gezmava, Moscow-trained singer, sang Mimi at Covent Garden last season. This year made debuts at the Met and Bavarian State Opera. Dagmar Petskova, Czech mezzo-soprano, has worked closely with Jerzy Bielochlávek, singing much Mahler this season. Stefan Finke, German tenor, soon to perform Siegfried in Ring Cycles in London and Seattle. And Jan Martinić, winner of the Song Prize 2 years ago at BBC Cardiff Singer of the World. Czech bass, who's a member now of the company of the Komische Oper in Berlin. David Good, international concert career, as well as being organist and head of keyboard at Eton College, taking his vows from the keyboard of the Royal Albert Hall organ. Well, we're back here at the Proms tomorrow night with Michele Pertuzzi and Matthew Rose amongst the cast of Rossini's William Tell, the orchestra and chorus of the Academy of Santa Cecilia Rome, conducted by Antonio Pappano. Sean Rafferty will be sitting in this box to introduce that tomorrow night at 6:30. Soloists now back on the platform. Rapturous applause from all around this building. How exciting it is to be back in the Royal Albert Hall once again. This great circular space, the arena filled with the enthusiasm of the Prommers, and rows of seats leading up to what, 3 tiers of velvet-clad boxes, more seats, and then those wonderfully lit arches above, the gallery Prommers, the acoustic domes providing a ceiling to this temple of music. Jerzy Bielochlávek will return later in the season. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, of course, as with all the BBC's performing group, such an integral part of this great festival. BBC Symphony Chorus on their feet again. The Proms continue. They're here for the next 8 weeks here on BBC Radio 3. For now, with the sound of the applause of the first night of the Proms ringing in our ears, good night from the Royal Albert Hall, and back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall. Wasn't it marvellous to hear the Glagolitic Mass from that new edition based on the original version of Janáček's score, A Labour of Love by the sound of it, and the performance too. Well, just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom on Monday afternoon at 2:00 here on BBC Radio 3. And before it on Monday afternoon,
the BBC Proms Chamber Music Series. Over the course of the Proms season, from now until the 5th of September, every Monday lunchtime, Radio 3 heads to London's Cadogan Hall for chamber music of all shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm. A stellar cast of instrumentalists includes Yo-Yo Ma, Christian Tetzlaff, and Les Talents Lyriques. And our season begins with Bach's Goldberg Variations, one of the peaks of the repertoire, performed by harpsichordist Mahan Esfahani. Chamber music at the BBC Proms, live Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And with tomorrow night's Rossini opera from the Proms in mind, in a little over 25 minutes tonight, in Radio 3's Cabaret of the Word, the Verb, Ian McMillan reminds us about Radio 3's poetry competition and, by way of encouragement, lets us hear his own contribution, a poem inspired by Rossini's William Tell. To enter the competition, listeners are invited to write a poem based on a piece of music from this year's prom concerts. So how about a poem inspired by Janáček's Glagolitic Mass? It's certainly an inspiring, life-affirming piece, isn't it? Life-changing even. Anyway, this week's edition of The Verb is at 10 o'clock tonight. We're staying with Janáček. This is one of his male voice choruses, not perhaps a familiar sight to him outside Czech lands, unless you know his last opera From the House of the Dead. Janáček, though, is probably familiar as a fervent nationalist, and this chorus, called simply the Czech Legion, was written in a matter of a couple of weeks in early November 1918, immediately after the Czech nation officially freed itself from centuries of foreign domination. Janáček more or less set himself up as an artistic spokesman for the resurrected national life of the country, and this chorus is effectively a hymn of gratitude to those who died for the cause of freedom. The singers at the premiere early in 1920 are the same choir, same in name anyway, as sing on this 1970 recording of it, the Moravian Teachers Choir. But even if you didn't know that, there's something about this singing, the style, the understanding of the idiom, which just declaims authenticity at you. Much of it a fascinating mix of singing and singing speech.
Náš verný dom, právě za tisící stojí,
Českou zemi.
Czech Legion by Janáček, music written to honour those who'd made the sacrifice to bring about the creation of Czechoslovakia in October 1918. Must be incredibly challenging to sing that, but seeming to hold no terrors for the performers there. The Moravian Teachers' Choir, conducted by Antonín Tučapský, a recording from 1970. One more Janáček chorus from them to follow it, this from 1922, and as extraordinary as anything from Janáček's second youth, so to speak, The Wandering Madman is a ballad about a harmless lunatic who spends his whole life searching for a stone, the Philosopher's Stone, which turns base metals into gold. One day he meets a country boy, sung here by a solo soprano, who asks the madman how he comes to have a gold chain round his neck. The madman suddenly remembers the chain was of iron, so he must at some stage have come into contact with the magical stone, held it in his hand, and only to throw it away. And he spends the rest of his days trying in vain to find it again. Rather touchingly, it seems, words from the wandering madman were inscribed on Janáček's tombstone. the Moravian Teachers Choir, conducted in 1970 by Antonín Tuchapsky in one of Janáček's male voice choruses, The Wandering Madman. Well, to follow that here on Radio 3, Poulenc's Elegy for Horn and Piano, music first heard on the 17th of February 1958 on the third programme, the network that eventually became the one you're listening to now. Poulenc wrote quite a few elegies of one kind or another in his later years, most of them for departed friends, though he didn't always call them elegies. This one was in memory of the great British horn player Dennis Brain, who died in a car crash in the summer of 1957. The horn player here, André Cazalet, with pianist Pascal Roger. Thank you. A sense of peace, if only just, emerging from those final bars of Poulenc's Elegy for Horn and Piano, the elegy written in 1957 in memory of horn player Denis Brain, and played there by André Cazalet with pianist Pascal Roger. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a little after 10 o'clock, and time now for our weekly visit to The Verb. Here's Ian McMillan.
Welcome to the last Verb of the current season, and we're feeling a bit end of termish in the studio, I can tell you. We're not doing any hard work. We've just brought along a few games while I tidy up my cupboards and try and persuade Philip Dodd to take his hamster home. Of course, being The Verb, these are verby games. We'll be playing the game of identity with the Native American comedian Chuckway Billy, the unwritten language game with the poets James Davis and Carol Watts, the game of love with the great Irish playwright Billy Roach, and a game that I call That's the Way to Peel an Apple. Rossini's overture to his opera William Tell, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by Lamberto Gardelli. Everybody knows that part of it, but the opera itself is rarely heard. It's on Radio 3 tomorrow as part of the Proms, nearly 200 years after it was first written. And we're going to be talking about the opera with the music critic Susan Hitch. And then we'll think about how you might write a poem inspired by it and then enter that poem in the Verb's Proms Poetry Competition. And maybe I'll write a poem myself about William Tell as a sort of test piece, a template, a control in a Petri dish. So maybe we will do some hard work on this last day of term after all. And let's begin with the unmade, the unwritten, the unredrafted, the discarded, the abandoned. James Davis is a poet and literary activist based in Manchester. He runs the If P Then Q Press and helps to organise the Other Room Poetry Nights in that rainy city. His own work is concerned with the possibilities of language, as all poetry should be, of course, but some poetry rarely is. And I've got to say that as soon as I saw his new book, I wanted to get him on the show. The first half of Plants consists of poems that are, as James says, deleted or untyped or rejected or simply not written. So, James, let's hear a few of these pieces to start with, because that's easier than me trying to describe them.
Apples. Written, typed, altered, deleted. 15th July, 05. Booty, which refers to an old lady's slipper. Conceived, 7th May. Written, 7th May. Considered, 7th May. Rejected, 9th May. Bottle Bank, which is a bottle bank in Spain. Written, 30th of July, 2006.
Fantastic. Now, for the listener at home, James, who hasn't seen these poems, there's the title, then a couple of lines of the unmade poem, then almost a full page of white space, so the look of the poem is important.
Yeah. They come in a sequence of 31 poems, and the poems that are in the sequence are poems where a sensation was wanted to be kept. There are obviously poems which have gone in the bin, lots of poems which have gone in the bin, but there was a sensation in these poems that I wanted to keep them. So there was something wrong with these poems in terms of the form or the content, but in some ways I wanted to convey the message, but also didn't want to convey the message. So there's a kind of paradox at work.
So the process here then, so for example, Apples, which was Apples, written, typed, altered, deleted. That genuinely happened then? You wrote a poem which you deleted. Are you playing with the audience's and the listeners' and the readers' expectations there?
There's a mixture throughout the whole collection, but in Apples that's genuine. All the dates are genuine. Mm. In Apples there are many, many versions of Apples, many, many drafts, which I haven't looked at for a long, long time. Some of them have gone off the word processor, some of them are stored in files. So in something like Apples, there are a lot of ghosts there. So as you've pointed out, there's a title, one or two lines to describe a deletion, and a lot of white space. But underneath that, there are many, many ghosts. That isn't the case for all the poems, but in that particular one, there are ghosts underneath the poem.
These other poems that have gone in the bin, that you haven't, that you've just thrown away, they've not made it then to unmade status in that way. They've just been thrown away rather than ending up in the book as unmade poems.
Yeah, there's a sensation to these 31 poems where they're really important, but at the same time, I wasn't able to convey that sense in these 31 poems.
Good. So we're also joined round the unfinished verb table by the poet and academic Carol Watts, who featured in the recent anthology of radical landscape poetry, The Ground Aslant, that we talked about on the programme. So, Carol, is James writing then in an unmade tradition here, do you think?
I think so. I mean, it's difficult to get across how funny these poems are. They are hilarious. Yeah. But that unmade tradition, I think, is a bit of a riff, really, on the idea of ready-mades in some ways. And that then would link it back into conceptual art practice, where you take, like Duchamp, a urinal and you put it in a museum. Mm. In the same way that you take these poems, and they are really anti-poems in a way, that make you think about what it is to write poems, what the concept of writing poetry is, or what it is to make them, the process, the idea behind them, rather than the actual poem itself. I mean, for me, it links back into a conceptual tradition of writing poetry. It might link also to Tristram Shandy or a funny anti-novel, where you've got a whole novel that goes on about the impossibility of writing a novel.
Yeah. That really interests me, because often the deleted poem is seen as a failure.
Right.
And yet James is celebrating the unwrittenness. Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, it's almost like a continual series of failures, if I could put it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one that you read about, The Booty, which is... It's got this wonderful sense of comic timing where you conceived 7th of May. You can kind of see the poem beginning to take place, you know, written 7th of May, but you never get to see it. Considered 7th of May, so you're having kind of afterthought about what that poem might be, and then rejected 9th of May. So it's as if each poem thinks about the failure of writing poetry, which is really the way that poems work in a way. I mean, I think it opens that up to a reader.
And even within the unmade, you're writing within a formal framework, because there are three unwritten sonnets here, aren't there?
Mm-hmm, there are.
Let's hear those unwritten sonnets, and then we'll talk about them.
The first one's called Sonnet. Various lines deleted on forgotten dates, 2005-6. Final line deleted 30th of July, 2006. The second one's got a kind of juvenile title. Kill your fellow employee, dismiss the link between this, that and the other with a grand employer. 14-line poem started, 2001, abandoned mid-2003. Its final sonnet in this sequence is in iambic pentameter. Sonnet. 13 lines dumped, 14th July, 06.
They do make you laugh. They are fantastically funny. Sometimes the title leads up the garden path. So three sausages, open brackets, and a parsnip, close brackets. That's funny. And they're meant to make us laugh, aren't they, James? We are meant to celebrate them with laughter and joy and glee.
Yeah, they're absurd. All poetry should be fun.
Yes.
Yeah, all poetry should be fun. Yeah.
And, Carol, James is playing with the expectations of the reader, though, in a comic way, isn't it? It's that when you see the titled sonnet, you kind of expect a sonnet, and then when you don't get one, the reader's expectations have been toyed with, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, as a reader, you're kind of wondering what zone you're in when you get into these poems. You're wondering where the poem takes place. And actually, there's a sneaking suspicion that you might really be faking it. I mean, that there may not be a poem there at all. Or in fact, the poem may never have been written. And so you begin to wonder whether you're hallucinating with these poems. I mean, is there a poem here or not? And in some ways, it opens up for the reader the world of the process of writing poetry. I think it does that very powerfully. But then once you're trying to work out, well, what is the relationship between, you know, Cod Farm and having a conversation with Paul on a particular date? We don't know whether the conversation ever took place. So we wonder whether the poet's actually really there at all. Is there a poet in this text?
There are three methods. So I've talked about the unwritten, so where there is a huge amount of text underneath and there are ghosts. But then there are poems which were not written, i.e. that there was a thought that took place, but I would never put pen to paper. And then there are conceits which come towards the end, which were really not even thought about. And what I've tried to do as I've gone along is forget which of those processes took place, and I don't ever look at the files again.
But it's interesting that as a reader, I feel invited in. I really feel as I'm invited in to complete, and then in many ways actually write the poem for you. When I see the title and I see the unwritten and I think, that reminds me when I come out of the post office.
in the way that the best poetry does. Even in these couple of lines, it makes you want to come in and play with the poem, doesn't it? Carol, it becomes a playful space, doesn't it?
It does, and actually you can begin to hear all of the poetic traditions or poems you might like coming through your own ear. I mean, like there's one here, The Longest Days Are Those Spent at Sea, which has got this amazing romantic title. You're into a sort of romantic zone of where poetry might take you. And then it says underneath, not written for Laura. Hmm. And 3:21 in the afternoon, 24th of March, 2007. So you're in this banal, everyday world. But it is the world that poetry comes from. I mean, that is the place where, if you like, romantic poems take place. So I think you do hear other kinds of poems coming through the airwaves, as it were.
Well, that particular poem, what attracted me to that very much was the precise time, the 3:21 in the afternoon. Isn't there a Tom Raworth poem that's set at a precise time?
Yeah, there's a sequence.
That's right.
So from Moving Images.
That's right. So it's a particular time. And then at 3:21 in the afternoon, when you read the poem, it's a kind of magical alchemy occurs. And that one was part of a sequence of love poems. So perhaps you could, we've heard that one, The Longest Day, so perhaps you could read the one on page 31 for us.
Sina, which is a name given to Danish females. Some Danish females. A poem for love. Attempted again, 3rd of the 12th, 06.
See, to me, the bit that stands out for me there that's really a heart puller is when you go again. Attempted again. I just love that. That is a real... There's a quality of love. I know it's about love, not for love, but just the idea of, with a love poem, with love, you attempt again. And it's just that word again leaps out at me.
Yeah. I think love poetry, it's the idea of love is perhaps even more powerful than an individual love, how to write about love in general. It's to write the poem, isn't it? The important poem about love is something that a lot of poets attempt, and I'm still attempting and fail at doing.
So, Carol, I mean, you teach writing, and I wonder if this would be a thing you could try with the students, this idea of the unwritten poem, the unfinished, the deleted poem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a long tradition of thinking about poems that erase themselves. But what I really love about these, I mean, there are two things really. One is that they make you think about the technology of how you write poems. I mean, actually, most of us now write poems onto screens. So there is this deletion moment, and yet it's deeply effective as well. I mean, the emotion is there, and yet the machine is there at the same time. So I think it's a great exercise, actually, to try and have poems that are taken away in the same gesture. I mean, that may have taken place, you know, because in a way you want, as a reader, to hear more and to invest more when you hear those. So I think it's a great exercise, actually. But it's more than an exercise.
Yes, it is. Let's finish with... I'll give the title, then you can as well, because then we can celebrate the title. Let's finish with Gecko's Redone from Memory, 30th of July, 2006.
Gecko's Redone from Memory, 30th July, 2006.
Many thanks to James Davis and Carol Watts. James Davis's book Plants is published by Reality Street Press. Here on The Verb, we're always interested in language as a way of defining who we are and who we can become. Chuckaway Billy is a member of the Lakota Sioux tribes who, by a convoluted route involving pen pals and open mic nights, has ended up, as he says, the only Native American stand-up in the UK. So, Billy, our mic is open.
Hello, Halito Chimachukma. I'm Chuckaway Billy. My tribal affiliation is Lakota, Sihasapa and Choctaw from the Choctaw, Mississippi. Actually, it's the other way around, Mississippi Choctaw. And now I am the only Native American Indian stand-up comedian on the UK's comedy circuit. That's because I'm the only Native American Indian in the UK. Right? And I don't mean Brazilian guys dressed as Native Americans either, playing pan pipes on corners, because they don't count. I'm from the USA, as my people call it, occupied America. Yeah, you think this country has too much immigration, huh? Sure you do. I understand. It's bad for us in America, though, right now, because our nations are always getting misappropriated, you know. They do things like they name their cars after us, you know, like the Jeep Grand Cherokee, the Ford Apache, you know, the Washington Redskins. They even called Osama bin Laden Geronimo. I mean, you don't do that to other cultures, do you? Like, you don't see the Mazda Muslim anywhere, do you? No, you don't. You don't see the Nissan Nigerian either. You don't. It's be careful about taking courses, weekend courses. Now, I know I'm going to get a lot of flack from this, probably from a lot of New Age people out there. jumping around in the mud in Glastonbury. But be careful, though, because you take these weekend courses and they come back on the Monday from the weekend and say, oh, all right, Steve or Fred or whatever your name is, and you must no longer call me by that name. My name is Eats the Rainbow, Beats the Wolf, because there's always a wolf in their name somewhere. I am Dances with Many Moons of Wolves. I don't understand why you do that. And then they have their little dream catchers on, and their little medicine bags on, and their moccasins, and they're walking around. Aho! Aho! You know? I mean, come on, I went to Germany for a weekend, okay? I didn't come back here wearing Lederhosen and saying, you have to call me by my German name. I'm a man called Horst. Okay, so that's where I'm coming from. That's where I'm coming from. I'm from Gallup, New Mexico. Have you been to Gallup? Anybody here?
No. I've passed through it.
You've been through it?
I have been through it.
You've been through Gallup?
On a Greyhound bus in 1977.
Well, people out there, if you've never been to Gallup, picture a Tuesday night in Milton Keynes without the nightlife and lots of pawn shops, and basically that's where I'm from. Yeah, and I grew up on a reservation out there, too, not far from there. I lived there with my parents until I moved out at the age of 38. I can't do the bit after that because it's really rude.
Okay, we can't.
But I'll tell you about our accents, you know, because two things that I've learned in this country since I've been here is, one, you don't jump to cue, and the other one is you don't do dodgy accents. And I've heard the accents that people here have done for Native American people, and frankly, it's kind of like Dick Van Dyke trying to do you guys, okay? Core blimey, Mary Poppins. Yeah, that's... I've heard what you guys... Oh, we welcome many moons... It sounds like a Klingon, okay? That's not us. We don't... Native people, we talk slow. We're very slow when we talk, you know?
So what about your name, Chukwai Billy? That must have a significance.
Well, Chukwai is a native name of the Choctaw Nation, and I can never tell you what it means because I didn't know. Right? They didn't tell me, right? Two sides of my family aren't talking to each other. Right? And they're not talking to me, but I had to Google my name. I did. You love that word, Google, don't you? I love saying it, Google, because it sounds rude. I thought my name was going to be profound, you know? I thought it was going to be like my relatives, like Crazy Horse or Red Cloud. You know, turns out Chukwai is just a native version of Barry.
Chukwai Billy, thank you very much. I'll tell you what, it's a real self-deprecating humour, that, isn't it? It's real, the self-deprecation in there, the slow delivery, the self-deprecating nature of it. I wonder how you arrive at that. What's the creative process for you? Do you write it down? Or is it all improvised on stage? Or is it already there in your head as your life story? I wonder what the creative process is.
Well, the style coming out, the self-deprecation, that's more like since I've moved to London, because that's kind of a London thing. If I did my set in America, it would be completely different. I'd be laughing at the British rather than the other way around.
But would it be in America? Would it be faster? Would it be more...
It'd be a lot faster. It'd be a lot more aggressive.
Right.
But we do, we talk really slow. Native people, we share a sense of irony that British people have, because like wordplay. When I first moved here, they used to call me an American Red Wolf in London. That was my Indian name, was Red Wolf. So, and it's little plays on things like that. It's very understated native comedy. Hasn't really caught on too much here. I haven't seen pretty much any mention anywhere, really, of native comedy. But there's a lot of Native American stand-up comedians, Charlie Hill and Junior Redwater and people in Canada.
Were you aware of that as a young man growing up in Gallup?
No, when I was in Gallup, I wanted to be a rock star. I did, and then that didn't work out. Then I joined a gang, and that didn't work either because we kept spray painting our names on chain link fences, so nobody knew about us. But we laugh, you know. Historically speaking, I mean, my father's people in the Lakota, I mean, we have what we call sacred clowns, the Heyoka, Wichashawakan, we call them. And our function in the old days was just to make everybody laugh and forget their problems, forget how we were all starving to death and or dying of smallpox or something. And Heyokas are healers, and we heal through laughter, and that's pretty much... I don't know if you ever saw a Little Big Man, but there was a scene where this guy runs in, and he's on a horse, he's riding it backwards, and he hides under a blanket, and the cavalry just runs right past him. And that's a Heyoka, that's what we do.
Your comedy then comes out of maybe a storytelling thing?
Yeah, it's just mostly me coming here and living here. I've lived here now about 9 years or so, and I've been watching. So, but I got into comedy about, I guess, 8 years ago. I was a musician before that, and I don't know, it just sort of happened.
I read that you relearn in Choctaw because you'd had it as a child, but then you had to go to a particular school where they wouldn't let you speak it.
Yeah, in the old days. I mean, they all the way up to the 70s, I think. I went to a boarding Indian boarding school. I mean, we weren't allowed to speak our language, so they would, if they caught you, they'd severely beat you. And I mean, so, and there's a whole generation of people out there, the native people that don't speak their language.
So you're relearning it?
I'm relearning it, yeah. I mean, and it was funny because I was learning it online, which was funny, you know, and it was all from Oklahoma, and they have a really heavy Oklahoma accent, and, you know, and then they speak Choctaw, and it was like, well, we're going to start talking now. Make sure you got your book to lesson number 9. Okay, halito chimachukma. What? Do what? What are you saying? That ain't how you say it. And then so what am I saying? So I'm learning.
And I wonder if you'd then consider performing in Choctaw. You should read about someone like Eddie Izzard, who performs his stand-up in French. Would the self-deprecating thing work, if not in a direct translation, but I'm interested in... If you performed in Choctaw, it would be a different thing, would it?
It is an idea. I did do it in Dutch once. I did some gigs in Amsterdam in front of 40 Dutch cops. Right. But I did, and the funny thing about it was the funnier bits were the Dutch bits. It was just me. And I said, Goed avond, dames en heren. Ik ben Chukwe. Ik ben niet uit Netherlands. Ja, klopt, which means I am not from the Netherlands. Yes, it's true. And they just fell on the floor laughing hysterically. No idea why. Different humour, I guess. I
suppose it is.
They like to throw things at people from bicycles. I don't know, but I enjoyed it. It was great.
Thank you very much to Chukwe Billy, or Barry, as we must call you now.
Call me Chukwe. Just don't call me Billy, because that gives me Vietnam flashbacks. Not getting shot at, just having to mop things, that's all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, as you know, a prom summer stretches before us like a long, luxurious musical bath before the nights start to draw in again. You've got to dig your scarf out of the drawer. The Verb's contribution to the proms is the proms poetry competition. We're asking you, ever so politely, to write a poem based on a piece of music at this year's proms. It could be a reaction to the music itself, in an abstract way. It could be something that the music illuminates in your memory. It could be a description of the actual playing of the music. All the details of the competition are on the proms website, and you've got till August the 6th to send us your stunning stanzas. The former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen is my fellow judge, and I personally can't wait to open my bulging sack. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, there's a rare revival of William Tell, Rossini's opera about the legendary founding fathers of Switzerland and the hero who shoots an apple from his son's head. This great tale and its music could be the very thing to inspire you to a sestina or two. Here's opera critic Susan Hitch to talk us through William Tell. So, Susan, just remind us of the story. So how come he ended up having to shoot an apple from his son's head?
Well, we're in Switzerland, it's the 14th century, and we have the very beginnings of a kind of revolutionary nationalist movement, which the great man William Tell doesn't entirely intend to belong to in the beginning. But there's a complicated story that leads up to the moment when Gessler, the Austrian overlord, is in the village square and he's put his hat on a pole. And everybody has to bow to it. And everybody does bow to it, except for William Tell, who's already turned up as a hero because he's the one who rode the great revolutionary over the lake to escape from Gessler at the beginning of the opera. And Gessler recognises him. Says, that's William Tell, that man standing there with the little boy. That's William Tell. And he won't bow to my hat. So he grabs him and then realises there's something completely appalling he can do. Gessler is a very good baddie, a very bad baddie. And he grabs the little boy, stands him there and puts an apple on his head and says, now, you're known as an archer. You shoot that apple off his head. Yeah. So William Tell does it. He manages to shoot the apple and not his son. He has a second arrow in his quiver, and the second arrow is the one he was going to use on Gessler if he missed and shot his son. And he tells Gessler that and is luckily rescued just in time by an army. And then when it's nice and official and a battle, William Tell does, in fact, shoot Gessler. Wow. And revolution breaks out all over Switzerland.
As it often does. let's think about the character William Tell. If we were writing a poem about him, how would we describe William Tell himself in terms of his character?
The first thing you see about him is that he's strong and he's brave and he probably doesn't care very much what other people think. He comes onto the scene not as the first great leader of the poem, nor is he the centre of the love story of the opera. He's the person who comes on first as the rescuer. The revolutionary Leuthold are being chased by the Austrian forces, and only William Tell can row him across the lake to safety in the middle of storm and waves and everything like that. So William Tell is the independent-minded, strong man, not in the first instance a revolutionary, who then joins with others to make the fight for freedom. And I think that's very important, because I think that William Tell becomes this great national hero figure, and he's heroic, all right, and brilliant at everything he does. This is not a mild portrait of an accidental hero, but there's also a sense in which he's an ordinary hero. He's a man of the people who isn't the love interest, he's a happy father. What we discover about him, I think, that really gives the apple moment point. There's an aria just before he shoots, when he's actually speaking to his son and saying to his son, "It's going to be all right. Just hold your nerve. Hold still. It'll be okay." And then the son goes and stands. And you remember that the whole thing depends as much on the son standing still with the apple on his head and trusting his father as it does on the father keeping this absolutely cool nerve. And I think that's very important, because it's easy for us to think, oh, yes, shoots an arrow. You and I have never used a bow and arrow, at least I haven't. This story comes out of a culture in which people had, and especially in England, actually, for centuries people had used arrows. The sense is still alive that this is an alive and dangerous weapon, that this is an appallingly difficult thing to do. So what we know about William Tell is that he's very, very cool in the face of danger.
And he's a bit like Robin Hood in that he's somebody that we've all heard of Robin Hood in England. At the time Rossini wrote the opera in the early 19th century, would all Swiss schoolchildren have known that tale, do you think?
I think less Swiss schoolchildren, perhaps, than everybody in the German Romantic movement who had seen Schiller's play.
Right.
So he was already a kind of Swiss legend, but actually in the entire German-speaking world he was a legend. It isn't just in the German-speaking world in Switzerland that there are legends like that. There's a native one to us. There's another kind of group of Robin Hood-like stories told about an Adam Bell and his friends William of Cloudesley and Clym of the Clough. And there's
never
an apple on his head story about William of Cloudesley, who's asked to shoot an apple, again by the local baddie, off his son's head and manages it in the same way.
I wish we had time to talk about Clym of the Clough. Somehow I suspect that we haven't. So, at its heart, it is this adventure story, but it does create and cement a Swiss national identity. Is that right? In the same way that the Icelandic sagas did for Iceland?
Yes. It's both a kind of local legend and a kind of invention. And what it does is throw back into the past, because it's set in the 14th century, the idea that in the 14th century the cantons of Switzerland would already have had an idea of Switzerland, of Swissness.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably, if it was true at all, they may have been trying to throw off overlords, but not with perhaps such an idea of Swissness.
And let's end with that abiding image of, which you've spoken about already, about shooting the apple from the son's head. How does it resonate for you as an image?
It's funny, you can hear it, can't you? I think that's one of the things about it. The sight of it is almost redundant. I think it's very interesting we're going to be hearing this on the radio, because when it was first performed in the 19th century, this was one of those operas that they threw everything at. You know, there were sets and paintings and storm scenes and what. Actually, you hear it better than you see it. And here, I think what you hear is the sense of the kind of thrum and the twang of the arrow and the crack of the apple that might have been the crack of the skull as that kind of near disaster absolutely achieved.
Thank you very much to Susan Hitch. And Antonio Papano conducts the orchestra and chorus of the Academy of Santa Cecilia, Rome, at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow with Michele Pertusi as William Tell. And at the end of tonight's Verb, I'll be reading my very own entry for the Proms Poetry Competition based on William Tell, which I'll be entering under the nom de prom Ivan McMiltman. I'll win, of course, but don't tell Radio 3. You're listening to the Verb with me, Ian McMillan, described in the Guardian newspaper recently as genial. Mind you, they also called me a few years ago relentlessly jolly, so I've matured. As ever, you can get details of everything you've heard on the show via the Radio 3 website and follow the links to the genial Verb homepage. A while ago on The Verb, we broadcast a story called Sussex Gardens by the Irish playwright Billy Roach. Billy is perhaps best known for his wonderful Wexford trilogy of plays, A Handful of Stars, Poor Beast in the Rain and Belfry, which examine small-town life in very close, very moving and, in the end, for me, very uplifting detail. His new play, Lay Me Down Softly, is on in London now. The previous piece he wrote for us, all those years ago, was about loneliness and love and the passage of time and desperate London hotels. And now, Billy's written a sequel to it, a Verb first, I reckon. Billy's in the Verbs Dublin studio, and actor Simone Kirby is with us here in London to read the new story. But first, Billy, remind us a bit about Sussex Gardens, the first story that we had.
Oh, yes, Sussex Gardens. It comes from a collection of short stories called Tales from Rainwater Pond. And it tells the story of Tommy Shannon, who comes to London in search of his runaway wife, really. It's a bit of an Orpheus tale of the guy going into the underworld in search of his beloved. And she ran away with another man, and he's coming to try and convince her to come home again. And, of course, Dog and Bone, which is a story you're about to hear, I decided to just have a little exploration of what her life is actually like.
Simone Kirby, let's hear Dog and Bone.
He's gone for good this time, I think. I don't know why I say that, but my sister Doris warned me about him. She said I'd rue the day, and I do. I rue the day. I know what that means now. He's done this before, although never for this long. Usually he'd stay out all night, come back in the morning. He's a gambler, cards and that. Needless to say, I'm not supposed to question him about it. Oh no, he gets all humpy if you ask him where he's been. Although he needs to know everything about me, everything I do, everywhere I go. Not that I ever go anywhere or do anything worth talking about anymore, because I don't, but he needs to know what I'm doing and thinking and feeling. One time, the last time, he was gone for nearly 3 days. He came back that time in an awful state, unshaved and unwashed and all his clothes all crumpled. I could smell her off him too, some East End slut. I got it all out of him eventually. They can't wait to tell you half the time. He kept saying it was all my fault, that I drove him to it with my constant jacking. He worked his fingers like a dog as he said it. He's only over here a wet day and he already does all that cockney crap. Doris says I should learn to keep my mouth shut, just grin and bear it. But what she's forgetting is that I gave up everything for him. A house and a home back in Ireland, a husband and a child and everything. Ramey Savage. That's his name. That's right, Savage. You should have read the tin, my sister Doris says to me on the phone the other day here. I should have fired the tin against the wall is what I should have done. I met him at a dance. My husband Tommy was up at the bar and Ramey just waltzed on over and asked me up. I didn't expect this tonight, he whispered in my ear as we danced. And Tommy never noticed, or if he did, he never said. Mind you, when he found out about the affair, he didn't do anything either, so you'd think he'd have wrecked the place, but no, he didn't. He said he was going to kill Ramey, but in the end he didn't even go down after him. I suppose I should have been grateful for that at the time, but I wasn't. Frankly, I was disappointed. And now I act like I'm living a double life here, peering out windows and drawing the blinds. I mean, what am I supposed to be hiding from exactly? I know, plenty, right? I try to keep busy. I work in the pub across the street, the Dog and Bone, a few hours a day. They offered me a job in the bar at night too, but I didn't take it. Ramey said he don't like the idea of me waiting on people. He's after taking my jewellery. Did I mention that? Yeah, he took the lot this time. He normally only takes a few things, but this time he's cleaned me out. He found my savings too and took it all. What does that tell you? That he's not coming back, right? That he's gone for good? Doris said this was bound to happen sooner or later, that he'd leave me here in squalor, and that's what he's done. He's left me in squalor. Someone's been looking for me. He came into the Dog and Bone last night and asked about me. Jean behind the counter confirmed to him that I did work there on and off, but she didn't tell him that I live right across the street. She said she wanted to check with me first, so she gave me a call. It's Tommy, looking for me to come back. And yeah, I know you think that's romantic, but it's not. I'm his property and he wants me back. That's all it is. And there's something else you should know, and I only found this out recently. He's seeing someone himself. Doris told me she heard something about it, and we get the local paper here too with all the news from home in that corner shop on the corner there. There was a picture of Tommy in the newspaper with this one at some dinner dance. Angie something or other. I mean, I know her to see. A real spitfire she is. So 9 months and he's already got a bit in the side. Yeah, missing me like crazy he is. Margaret is the child's name. And yes, I have pictures of her, of course I do. I just don't put them up, that's all. It'd be a bit hypocritical after what I've done. But I do harbour notions of her coming over here someday, to visit her, to stay permanently if she wanted to, when she's older. Tommy's mad about her. The young one, he calls her. Whatever she wants, whenever she wants it, he'd say. And I'm not ashamed to admit this. Well, I am ashamed of it, actually, but I'm going to say it anyway. I resented it. I know. It's awful. I'm awful. I could take her from him, you know, if I wanted to. 9 times out of 10, the judge will side with the mother, right? Yeah, if I wanted to hurt him, like really hurt him, that's the way to do it. I might threaten him with that, actually, if he doesn't leave me alone. I've just been talking to the landlord down in the hall. He wants us out. He says he don't care about the money we owe him. It's not worth it, he says. We're not worth having, were the exact words he used. I don't know what to do. I've hardly any money left, and it looks like Raimi's not coming back now. Doris is right, I've been abandoned. Tommy came out of the coffee shop next door and went over to the Dog and Bone while I was down in the hall. I could see him through the frosted glass in the front door, dodging the traffic as he crossed the busy street. He's over there now waiting for me as if he knew. And I know what you're thinking, that I'll probably end up going back with him now, but I won't. No, that's one thing I can assure you that's not going to happen. I mean, come on, how can I? No. No way. No chance, mate.
Thank you very much. That was Simone Kirby reading The Dog and Bone by Billy Roach. So, Billy, what's it like revisiting these characters after 6 years, which is when you were last on The Verb?
Yes, well, it's very strange and a bit mad, really, isn't it? I should be cracking on with new stuff. But it was kind of a story that was haunting me and dying to be told, really. And in some ways, listening to that story again and Sussex Gardens, it is a kind of a cross between the playwright and the novelist in me, because both stories are kind of written to be read out loud.
A lot of your work is about the cramping effect of small-town communities. And yet when Helen escapes to the city, when she gets to London, it seems her life still revolves around that small area. She works in the pub, she lives nearby, so she's swapped this one small community for another, hasn't she?
Yeah, there's a claustrophobia about the small town. It's a lovely way of life if you happen to be made for it. But if, like Helen, you resent your wings being clipped, really, it's a life sentence. I think here at the end of the story, we probably suspect that she will be forced to return with him, and doesn't bode well for life, does it?
Doesn't really. You do really well capture the poetry of everyday speech. That great phrase, "he worked his fingers like a talking dog," was great. And the girlfriend's a real spitfire. And I wonder how you do that. You collect the phrases? Is it a matter of listening in, partly inventing, partly altering a phrase once you've heard it to fit your rhythms?
Well, you know, it's very much in my bones, the language of my place, which as a writer I'm kind of attracted to and feel a little bit of a duty towards keeping it alive, because we're living in an age when accents and rhythm and certain words are dying out, and it would be a shame to see beautiful words dying and phrases dying. So a lot of the stuff I get credit for actually is the commonplace back home, you know. But I take the credit and the money.
I wonder if you had any particular examples of words and phrases that you've helped to preserve by putting them in a play.
Yeah, words from home. Figeri is a word we use back home. Someone takes a sudden figeri to do something, which has its roots in the word vagary, the Latin word to wander. In our language, figeri is spelt with an F. Stocious drunk is a word we use quite often. Somebody could stocious drunk. I believe that word turns up in Joyce as well. Dying alive about somebody, to be dying alive about somebody, a beautiful phrase. And again, I've got great credit for writing that line, but if you come to Wexford, you'll hear it on every street corner.
What does it mean, everybody's dying alive? What does it mean?
To be absolutely mad.